Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet, and we're heard 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay with us for tonight's special report on When You Ride Alone, You Ride With Bin Laden. We'll be back right after this. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy. The richest one-half of 1% of our population with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of that tax have been more than fully realized. And by the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. This year, the average American family works all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal and state taxes. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us today? This income tax and social security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And this income tax and the social security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and social security is the eighth plank. And that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask this question. Do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org. And click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Bill Maher is a political satirist. He was on ABC for some time on a television show. He writes, and he does entertainment. He's written a book called When You Ride With Bin Laden, or When You Ride Alone, rather, You Ride With Bin Laden, as a takeoff from a World War II adage or cliche that said, when you ride alone, you ride with Hitler. The book is designed to take an introspective look at we Americans in the aftermath of 9/11 and the war on terror. They're a series, the book is written in a series of short monologues, short treatises, analyzing the various and sundry activities that we Americans are engaged in, such as putting flags on our cars and buying SUVs. And one of the monologues is entitled Slaves to Our Freedom. Listen to this story and see if you agree. He says, evolution is about survival of the fittest, adapting to adversity, immunizing oneself from that which poses a threat. And as we begin to recognize our oil dependence is an Achilles heel, well then, I would say that it's time for us to do a little evolving. After World War II, Americans started treating gasoline as if it were a necessity, a necessary element for sustaining life, like food, air, water, and television. We preach about capitalism and the beauty of unfettered market forces determining price, but not when it comes to gas. When it comes to gas, we need it cheap. And the president had better get it for us or else, and we don't care how. And if it takes 100,000 dead Iraqi soldiers to keep gas below $2 a gallon, then the rest of the world pays $5. Then, if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. Now, that's the price of gasoline. Now, just look what happens when gasoline prices go up by even a few cents. Americans throw an embarrassingly juvenile tantrum, outraged that they have to think twice before taking the couch mobile to Walmart for a bucket of Rocky Road and a lawn bag full of potato chips. Gasoline in Great Britain costs $5.70 a gallon. In the United States, if it goes to $2 a gallon, we'll throw a hissy fit. Now, it's a funny thing about Americans. We love to bitch about paying too much for things we really need and that are really a bargain. For instance, like gasoline and postage stamps. But we willingly shell out outrageous amounts for unnecessary crap like gourmet coffee and soap to make our crotch smell good. $2 a gallon gas to go 10 miles is too much. But $5 to the parking valet to go 10 feet is okay. Now, we should stop worrying so much about the price of gasoline and start considering its cost. You really want to be patriotic? Well, don't change your car by putting a flag on it. Change your car and improving our overall fuel efficiency by just 2.7 miles per gallon would completely eliminate our need for oil from the Persian Gulf. You know, that's where all the troublemakers come from. And until we can wean ourselves off of the good imported stuff altogether, and we'll have to do that someday, whether we like it or not, conservation then is our only sound recourse for the present. Oh, sure, there's our domestic supply, you know, that private bottle that we keep in a desk drawer. But even if we drilled in every wildlife refuge and put oil rigs on all of our coasts, we'd still only be tapping about 2% of the world's reserves, barely enough to continue producing Astroglide. And what are we doing it all for? The big garish automobiles that we want to make us feel so powerful, but of course they cannot. Stop calling SUVs because it stands for sport utility, and soccer moms and football dads are not using these Leviathans for sports, nor are they using them for utilities. Unlike in the commercials, very few people use them to cross the Rockies because, you know, wherever Lewis and Clark went, ditto goes the navigator. In the commercials, every model is a totally new driving experience. Please, a totally new driving experience would be a car with wings. Does this car fly? Otherwise, everything is still basically a Chevy. So let's cut the crap. We're driving school bus-sized urban assault vehicles around town, and that's just the women. The men want to be rebels. Oh, yeah. You're a sexy off-road radical because you're in a Pontiac. You're not one of the masses. Hey, wouldn't it be great to go to a PTA meeting in a Sherman tank? Wouldn't that be the coolest? That's not something everybody could do. Perish the thought of something available to everyone. Members only, baby. And by the way, selfish utility drivers, I personally don't want other motorists sitting high enough to see what's going on in my lap. The irony is that we love, and what we love most about our cars is the feeling of freedom that they provide. And that feeling of freedom has made us slaves. Slaves to cheap oil, which has corrupted our politics and threatened our environment, funded our enemies, and had us doing the dirty work for a lot of royalist dirtbags in the Middle East for a very long time now. It's time that we take a good hard look at our driving, and this is something we have to do for ourselves because our leaders aren't going to help us very much. They're like the lush on the next bar stool who drinks more than you do. Faced with our addiction to oil, what does our leadership say? Get more of it. Strange when you consider that their answer to drug dependence is to cut off the supply. He wrote another treatise in the book on dope. And he said, as it relates to dope, I could never be a politician, and for many reasons. For many reasons. One of the reasons is I like to change my mind. Maybe it's just my feminine side crying to get out of my male body, but I do. And in politics, you can't change your mind, which is very stupid because it means voters encourage a candidate not to grow and think. Now, if you're running for office and your position on any issue has changed the slightest bit since you were in grade school, then you're waffling. And you're forever after labeled a waffler. Even if it means ignoring new information coming to light. Be consistent. God forbid that you read an article when you got into junior high that gave you information that changed your mind. Changed your mind? In attack ads, you'd find out that's why you can't be trusted. You changed your mind. Therefore, you can't be trusted. Now, the sad thing is that this shit works. The real axis of evil in America is the genius of our marketing and the gullibility of our people. It's a deadly hookup when you can't sell them anything, and the American people have been sold drug paranoia so long that it's now a tradition. Politics based on pure ignorance and fear with detriment, not just to those who get arrested, but to innocent people who never get back their seized property, to kids whose parents go away for smoking pot, to high-crime neighborhoods that go under-policed because the cops are both corrupted by the drug trade and the busy chasing of the dealers. Now, we laugh at reefer madness like, wow, how ridiculous people are about pot back then. But we don't deserve to laugh because nothing has changed. And why hasn't anything changed? Well, because it's an easy political sale. Accusing your opponent of being soft on drugs is money in the bank as far as attack ads go. So why not go for it? You're running for office. You have no spine. You just want to be famous and are too ugly for show business. So even though you don't really believe that we should be draconian on pot smoking, you'll say that just to stake out that issue in the attack ads. Except then, when you get elected on your stupid ideas, you have to try to turn them into laws. Otherwise, in the next election, the guy that beat you with your cynical attack ads will accuse you in his cynical attack ads of not following through on your campaign promise of the death penalty for anyone with a Bob Marley record. Early in the 20th century, starting with a false marketing campaign, Americans abandoned their previous policy of government non-interference in whatever people wanted to do to take the edge off, put the edge on, or get it up, or put it down. And we've been the worse for it ever since. There are real victims in this drug war. Where's the Dateline Frosty Lens report on the pot-smoking daddy who never came home? There's some swing sets going unpushed in the drug war, too, if the 700,000 annual pot arrests mean anything. My last best hope of ending the drug war quickly ended shortly after 9/11 when it became apparent that we were all politicians, and even in light of new information, you know, the we're under attack thing. We still did not waffle, we stayed loyal to stupidity, and the stupid stuff that had always failed because we're loyal and have honor and integrity, the drug war would continue. But for a couple of weeks there, I had hope. After all, a new day had dawned, and everyone was in agreement that we'd just gotten our priorities slapped into shape like 2 weeks at juvenile boot camp. Attorney General John Ashcroft said, "We cannot do everything at once, did because lives now depended on us doing a few things very well." Right on, John. Real cool. Well said. The guy really gets it. Well, except, of course, he doesn't, he didn't, and he won't, and he didn't really mean it either. Now, let's cut to February 12th, 2002. That was the target date for the most specific FBI-issued terrorist warning since the 9/11 attacks. This was before the color-coded alert system, so it was somewhere between heads-up and danger, Will Robinson, and where were our federal authorities? Well, at least some of them were kicking in the doors of California medical marijuana dispensaries for AIDS and cancer patients. They didn't catch any actual hijackers, but they did nab a guy named Jack, who was high on dope. On that same day, President Bush announced, "If you're buying illegal drugs in America, it's likely that the money is going to end up in the hands of terrorist organizations," echoing the television ad campaign that premiered 2 weeks earlier on the Super Bowl. Because those Super Bowl ads are real cheap, so what a good use of terrorist fighting money, huh? It was all part of the administration's plan to piggyback their drug war agenda onto the blank check of support that they were receiving for the other war, you know, the one everyone was really behind in making political headway, for the war had become the new For the Children. It was all part of the administration's plan, then, to increase the war on drugs, using it as an excuse for the war on terror. But in the same way our airport security suffers when we spend finite time and manpower pretending everyone is equally likely to blow up the plane, like old ladies from Germany traveling through the United States need to be taken out of line and scrutinized, so does our defense suffer when we pretend the drug trade is the real piggy bank for crazy Arabs. You know, it's one thing for our American government to have abdicated the role of helping citizens and make connections in time of war, as we have seen that they have done. But it's even worse when the government purposefully misleads the public to the wrong connection. You actually do more to support Al-Qaeda by driving when you go out to pick up your drugs. Hell, all of us can help by driving less, but unfortunately not everyone has a smack habit to give up. And among those who do is George Bush, really wants you to do. Going to be the thing that makes a junkie quit? No, the target of drugs, as Fox terrorist connection number one, has chosen or was chosen because it's politically perfect, it's politically correct. Truly a dream come true for any administration's top spinmeister, because it targets something. It targets drugs that has been successfully demonized, certified evil from decades of marketing. And second, it asks absolutely nothing of 99.9% of the people, because heroin is the only drug that really benefits terrorists. So when even a crackhead hears drugs fund terrorism, he can say, well, he's not talking about me. And third, it takes the heat off the oil companies, who make a hell of a lot more campaign contributions than drug dealers do to our political system. Which is not to say that contributions from more than a few drug dealers haven't slipped through over the years. They probably have. But then the candidate has to send the check back and pretend he really cares where that money came from. I promise you, he doesn't. oil companies, car companies, that's the big chunk of the economy and a lot of contributions for political parties. Not to mention that we Americans love our Lincoln Navigators. So that leaves the druggies to take the heat on sacrificing for the war. At least until we can find a way to blame it on the smokers. And oh, by the way, if you're looking for an actual connection between drugs and terrorism, there is one. But it's a little 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. You see, the religiously conservative Taliban forbade involvement in the heroin or opium trade, and they stamped it out. It's the Northern Alliance, you know, the people who are our allies in Afghanistan, who cultivate and deal in the substances that find their way to America under such colorful names as China White and Tango and Cash. But hey, ally, enemy, minor point. When you've got the evil of drugs working for you in the ad campaign, just as long as we all know, the president should conceivably be calling on Americans to support our allies by increasing their heroin use. Where's the ad that says, hey America, why not switch from that skunky tasting import beer to smack? I guess I ought to point out, as I have recently, that during the last century, the drug trade was divided up among the wealthiest families, you know, like the Astors, the Windsors, the royal families, the nobility of Europe. That's where the money is, and of course they divide up these lucrative trades, banking, drugs. Well, take a look at drug production in the world today. Most of it comes from, it is the crack cocaine, and the marijuana comes from South America, Mexico, Colombia. And have you noticed that in the, or that with the billions of dollars that we've been spending on the war on drugs, that the quantity of drugs has not gone down, and the price has remained stable? We have all of this rhetoric that tells us that drugs are bad and that we want to prohibit drugs and we want to do something about drugs. And we've got the money to do it. And we're spending it. But nothing actually has been accomplished in at least the 10 or 15 years that I've been watching it. Now let's take a look at the heroin drug trade. The Taliban, those wicked, evil fellows, those terrorists over in Afghanistan, stamped out the heroin poppy production in Afghanistan. Afghanistan was the world's largest producer of heroin, the poppies that make this heroin. They stamped it out, and they didn't have the billions of dollars in the war on drugs that we Americans have to spend here in the United States in our alleged war on drugs, which is not a war on drugs. It's a charade. It's a sham. It sucks up a lot of money, makes us all feel good, but it doesn't accomplish anything. The Taliban, without any money in the poorest country or one of the poorest countries in the world, stamped out, for all practical purposes, they stamped out the opium production in Afghanistan by the year 2001. I suspect that that's one of the reasons, if not the chief reason, for going to war against the Taliban. They're a bunch of religious kooks, and they knocked off the heroin trade. 75% of the world's heroin came out of Afghanistan and could not easily be taken up by other countries. Now, since America has conquered Afghanistan with our allies, the Northern Alliance, opium production under the Taliban had been reduced from 75% of the world's opium production to a mere 4,000 acres in production. Under American occupation in Afghanistan, it has now gone up from 4,000 acres in 2001 to 77,000 acres in 2002 to 150,000 acres in 2003 until in the year 2004 it's up to over 200,000 acres, and Afghanistan is now producing more opium than it ever produced prior to the Taliban. Now, does that tell you that the Americans have an effective war on drugs and really want to stamp out the source of drugs from the countries like Colombia and Afghanistan where it comes from? America is highly involved in the war on drugs in Colombia, and there hasn't been any reduction in the supply of cocaine or marijuana from Colombia. Does that tell you something? In Afghanistan, the enemies of America, the terrorists, the wicked evil fellows, stamped out the opium trade in Afghanistan without any money. When we Americans took over with our war on drugs, we now observe that the production of opium has gone from 4,000 to 200,000 acres and in just 2 years. Now, boys and girls, that's not just a coincidence. That's business. That's American business. And where's the outrage for all of this? You know, I think we need to change that old saying, I don't need a building to fall on me, because two buildings did fall on us and we still haven't got it. We all do it, of course. Sticking our heads in the sand is a deep human impulse. Like when you feel some kind of bump or growth on the back of your neck and your heart jumps because, oh my God, that could be something bad. That could be cancer. I should see a doctor right away. But then you don't, because it's too scary. And what if they do find something? What if it is cancer and besides, maybe it'll just go away? Well, something growing under my skin, bubbling up from inside me somehow, literally a problem coming to the surface. Let's make that our very sixth priority, not number one. Now, people are funny about warnings and precautions. Warnings can be very frightening and imposing and require action. And who needs that kind of hassle? Now, remember Jeffrey Dahmer, the homosexual pedophile who killed and ate his victims? Well, months before his eventual arrest, an Asian teenager, a male Asian teenager, came running from Dahmer's apartment naked, bleeding from the rectum, and pleading for police officers to help him. The cops wrote it off as a likely domestic disturbance. You know, naked, in shock, bleeding from the rectum. Just another gay tiff. No red flag there. And yet the press found a story where Jeffrey Dahmer was caught sneaking into the Honor Society photo every year in high school. And they made it seem like that should have been the red flag. How did we not see it coming? Sneaking into the Honor Society photo, eating Asian teenagers. Duh. It was an obvious, desperate cry for help. And now we must ask ourselves, what can we do to make sure that it never happens again? Stricter policing of Honor Society photo sessions. That's probably the best solution, don't you think? Now, I challenge my opponent to sign a pledge making it a federal crime for anyone caught sneaking into high school photo sessions, and if he doesn't sign it, he'll be threatening our children. And by the way, hack politicians promising to make more and more crimes federal is one reason that the FBI didn't have time for terrorism. But hey, carjacking is down 2%. Now, in a similar way, why do people act shocked when a NASCAR driver gets into an accident and dies? What? No. Wow. 1 minute he's flying around an oil-slick track at 200 miles an hour, bobbing and weaving between cars, and the next minute, he's gone. My God, I'm shocked. He was standing right next to me an hour ago, and then he got in the car and fate. Huh? Yes, that one came out of the blue, but remember the American nuclear submarine that surfaced directly under a Japanese fishing boat, killing 9 people? That we have to stop from happening again, like it ever would happen again. Have you been on the ocean? The ocean is big. It's literally an ocean of water. and that a Japanese fisherman could awaken one morning, as he does every day, by lunch, have a Los Angeles class action submarine up surface and hit his boat just means a certain allowance for fate should be accorded here, don't you think? America is bad at discriminating between danger likely to strike again and red herrings, the freakish helpings of disaster that no man on planet Earth could prevent, foresee, or prepare for. Now, with all due respect to the poor souls who didn't deserve to die in New York, a successful breaching of America's Defense Corps, speaking from reason and not sentiment, should be a whole lot more worrisome. Having the Pentagon attacked is a red flag, not a red herring. The flag does not get redder or realer than that. With all due respect to the poor souls who didn't deserve to die in New York, you know, a successful breaching of America's Defense Corps, the Pentagon, speaking from reason and not sentiment, should be more worrisome. And it should serve as the highest possible warning of danger. The World Trade Center was the one that got more attention and aroused more feelings. So, of course, the media loved it. But attacking the Pentagon? That's our Defense Department, the castle keep, the place that's supposed to be secure within the secure place. It's threatening your queen in a very direct way. When the enemy gets to your citadel, your prided epicenter, everything's in play. When the Viet Cong ran amok in the capital of South Vietnam back in 1968 in the Tet Offensive, that was when people were here in America started to really freak out after and about the war, and rightly so. But Tet and Walter Cronkite's pronouncement after it that the war couldn't be won probably changed America's minds of that era more than his brazen attack on our own capital today. 2 months after Tet, a sitting president who loved the office and the power abdicated. People were mad at him, and he knew it. He'd like to see a little more of that anger from people now. Any time that we find out that the fight against terrorism is being shortchanged by the politics and greed, we should bare our teeth at Washington. We should have done it a few times already, but we haven't. For example, when in December of 2001 President Bush said civilization is at stake, that was just 1 week after announcing that if Congress asked for more than a $40 billion earmarked to fight terrorism, he'd veto it. So while pledging $140 billion to a no-strings-attached tax give-back to corporate campaign donors and $5 billion to an airline bailout, we capped civilization off at a non-negotiable $40 billion. The brave Argentinian author Jacobo Timmerman once said, probably from his jail cell, "It's very easy to hate a Nazi, a guardian in a gulag, but the real danger is not the Gestapo, it is the decent people who compromise with evil." Eric Koffer said, "The mystery of our time is the inability of decent people to get angry." I realize that sadness is a much safer emotion, but it is necessary to have a demonized anger in America. McCain, hey, doesn't he have a temper? Yeah, I think I read that. Oh, I don't know about him. Can you trust a guy who actually gets mad? Can you trust a guy who doesn't get mad? Let's get a guy with a temper. Maybe spending 5 years in a box in Vietnam makes a man a little cranky, but it also gives you first-hand experience with evildoers, and maybe we need a little more experience with evildoers than we've seen so far. Hey, I got to take a quick break here. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by the Gordon Law School, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. You know, when you buy a $10 pizza, it has a 38% tax on it. Did you know that? The Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax on it. And a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. We all know that. But can you honestly answer the question, what does the government do to produce, prepare, or deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, and 72% for a drink? Does the guy at the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on a pizza that he has to buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Why does the government get paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that you and I buy? Well, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and Status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org to order yours. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. Bill Maher, the political satirist, wrote a book. It's called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden. Let me tell you where you can get a copy. I think I got this one at Barnes & Noble. It's When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden. It's Bill Maher. He spells his name M-A-H-E-R. New Millennium Press, Beverly Hills is the company that puts it out. It's a 8.5 by 11 book. It's big. It's a series of treatises that Bill wrote. And I think they're right on point. They're a little bit pointed, and they use some saucy language from time to time, but I think that as adults, I think we could probably stand a little more saucy language, as you just pointed out, from guys like John McCain. Well, I've aired some of these stories. I want to tell you about the man in the sky. The real celebrity deathmatch. Religion can really be dangerous. Now, having always defined political correctness as the elevation of sensitivity over truth, and being an optimist, I guess that after 9/11, Americans would judge all matters PC. To be an indulgent herewith unaffordable boy, was I wrong? Which is really bad, because political correctness is much more dangerous now than it was before 9/11. What were once the kind of lies that we told to spare anyone's feelings from ever getting bruised are now revealed as blind spots in our rationale, inhibiting our ability to fully grasp our predicament in the world today. And there's nothing more politically correct than pretending religion is always a good thing. Saying someone is religious is heard in almost all Americans as a compliment, a reassuring affirmation that someone will be moral and ethical, and after a few glasses of wine, a freak in the bedroom. People say, "I'm a Christian," the way certain politicians say, "I have integrity." Like we're all supposed to be impressed and back off and kneel down to that almighty testament of naivete and hypocrisy. When people brag that they have religious faith, I hear stupidity. Faith is saying, I will ignore my God-given gifts for discerning reality and instead throw my lot in with blind belief in something that was forced into my head before I could even think clearly for myself. Isn't that how we get adults in this world who fight wars based on which contrived fairy tale they were brought up believing in? Which desert mirage they were programmed to see? The magic apple and the talking bush, or the flying horse and circling the black rock? But hey, you have to respect people's religion. I mean, it's politically correct. Why? Well, I don't. And I don't respect thinking that is dangerous, prejudicial, childish, and could get me killed. And to pretend, as we are apparently supposed to today, that the terrorism that we face today is not about religion is like saying AIDS in America has no relationship to homosexuality. It'll get you applause on Oprah, but it's not true. It's a lie. And also an applause line, but complete bullshit, is this is not a clash of civilizations. Of course this is a clash of civilizations, as every war is a clash of civilizations. The Civil War was a clash of civilizations, and we didn't even leave the country for that clash of our civilization. To hear people the week after 9/11 constantly talking up the need for more faith and the importuning of our God was, to me, the very definition of being part of the problem, not the solution. Of course, we in the West like to pat ourselves on the back and say that we're more tolerant, and we are. But tolerance is not the same thing as accepting and acceptance. It just means we think you're crazy, and we think you're going to hell, but we won't kill you for it. We will tolerate you. But you don't know who the man in the sky is, and we do. Now, our own president said during the 2000 campaign that he didn't believe one could get into heaven if he's not a Christian. Now, he had to backpedal on it because non-Christians vote too. But you see, millions of Christians who aren't running for anything would endorse that view wholeheartedly. And why wouldn't they? Since they treat the Bible like it's some kind of Bible, and in it there are words, and I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by me. Not a lot of wiggle room there. Now, put that next to there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet, and it's pretty much pick one side or the other. One lane open on the highway to heaven. This is a clash of civilizations. Of course, when you shut off your brain from rational analysis, any book is dangerous. Taking literally ancient parables from thousands of years ago is much more dangerous than playing with a loaded gun. Ancient scrolls written by different authors in different centuries with different agendas. Yeah, let's get mad literal about that. The literalness problem is compounded in religion by the circular logic of not being allowed to question anything, or else you're lacking faith. Christianity and Islam both have strict bans on of any sort of questioning of the religion itself, or, as the wizard once put it, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. In the Bible, it's don't eat from the tree of knowledge, but the meaning is the same. The stuff you're telling, or that we're telling you, is going to seem crazy, but we want you to buy it anyway. Imagine being able to sell any other product like that. By insisting that the customer swallow every word that you spoke about it as gospel, or else he'll be burned in hell. Where you, as the customer, having been brainwashed from birth about the superiority of your religious product, upon reaching thinking age, forfeit the benefits of the product if you doubt it in any way, and the claims of the product cannot be tested until after you're dead. Maybe that's why religion is a magic word that allows priesthoods to do anything they want to people. The Taliban kept their women in beekeeper suits. The Catholics got away with assaulting kids. If Islam was seen as an ideology instead of a religion, it would be easy to point a finger in the face of the enemy. But with a religion, no matter how vicious this religion gets, it gets a little touchy because, again, we'd hate to come off as intolerant, wouldn't we? So we'd like to make it clear that this is a war on terror, and there's no need for us to go digging into exactly where all that hate is coming from. It couldn't be coming from religion, could it? But if you must know, it's coming from the Koran, or more accurately, a conveniently literal interpretation of the Koran that informs the impoverished and the frustrated and the humiliated of their righteous duty to strike out, to kill, to wage jihad in the name of their God. The Korans, wherever you are, death will find you out. Even if you are in towers built up strong and high, does not mean fly airplanes into buildings any more than the story of the tortoise and the hare means that rabbits are born losers. But again, that's religion, isn't it? So we have to respect that, and we have to take it literally. Now, my personal savior is called common sense, and as far as God goes, I prefer to believe in one that would want me to use the excellent brain that he gave me and gave us all. Now, he wrote another treatise here called The Oxygen of Terrorism. I think I get time for one more in this program. We can do without it. During World War II, we had rationing in America. We rationed gas. We rationed meat. There was a spirit of camaraderie. There was a spirit of sacrifice. There was a spirit of, we can live without it, and we will. Now, the oxygen of terrorism, Bill Maher goes on to say, until warfare becomes completely automated, women will never do as much as men in war. Men are physically stronger, and so we need more men out front and on the battlefield more. That's just reality, and any arguments to the contrary is just politics, and feminist politics at that. But when called upon in America, women have given 100% of what they can give, which is enormous, and it's essential. Just like in the workplace, women who are good workers are the best workers. But give up diamonds? You know, that's a gut check for women today who might want to compare themselves to women of another generation, that of my mother, who was an army nurse during World War II and never expected diamonds, let alone worried about giving them up. Now, Colin Powell said, money is the oxygen of terrorism, which is Secretary of State talk for it's all about the Benjamins. And terrorists don't use banks or securities, which are assets that can be frozen. They're crazy, but they're not stupid. And they don't hide it under their mattresses. We've seen the caves. No, the bin Ladens of this world take their dirty oil money and convert it into dirty, untraceable things like diamonds. Diamonds are small, easily smuggled, not stopped by metal detectors, and can't be identified by dogs. And although they can be sniffed out by women from about 1,000 yards away, that's over 9 football fields to you and me. Now, not only are diamonds a perfect way for terrorists to launder their money, it's the one thing that they do launder. But diamonds actually appreciate in value, so the bad guys see a profit when they convert their diamonds back into cash. So guys, when you're buying her that diamond to tell her you'd do it all over again, you might be enabling the terrorist to do it all over again also. A diamond may be forever, but terrorism, promiscuously funded, will be there too. Let's make the connection clearly by tracing the path of the diamond. Diamonds start out in the earth, and eventually that earth is part of a country like Sierra Leone, Angola, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And in those countries, desperate battles for control have been going on for decades, and the armies that fight the battles finance their ambitions with diamonds. Villagers are forced to mine the diamonds by ruthless rebels who maintain order through terror, by raping the women and hacking off the limbs of little children, something, by the way, you never see in the De Beers ads. The rebels then smuggle the diamonds into neighboring dictatorships in Africa in exchange for guns and cash. There, the diamonds are sold to the highest bidder. whether they be terrorists or legitimate Jewish diamond dealers. And finally, they're laundered in Europe, shipped to America, and they end up in jewelry stores where they're purchased by men and women, given to women in exchange for oral sex. In the feminized nation that we live in, it's practically national policy that women are more evolved than men. But if that's so, how come they're still so impressed by shiny objects? Women complain that men are mesmerized by big breasts, but unlike diamonds, which are a commodity, at least breasts are natural. Well, not so much in Los Angeles, but in general, breasts are natural. I know it's hard. Women think about diamonds like men think about sex, like leeches think about blood. I once told a woman, who happens to be one of the nicest people ever, who only lives to help injured puppies and lonely children and old people, about the horrible situation in Africa with the diamonds. I told her about the rebels and how they cut off the arms of babies and children. Also, they can control and sell diamonds. My friend looked sad and forlorn, and then in a tiny voice she asked me, "Both arms?" Diamonds are sold to the highest bidder, whether they be terrorists or legitimate dealers, and finally they're laundered in Europe, shipped to America, and they end up in jewelry stores where they're purchased by men and given to women in exchange for sex. And all at the expense of little children's arms. Well, in the months following 9/11, many were labeled traitors by our government. American Taliban, John Walker Lind, American Al-Qaeda, Jose Padilla, and Senator Tom Daschle. It was easy to point an accusing finger at the very apparent traitors, those who had taken up arms against our country, or worse yet, dared to question the administration's policy on fighting terror. But just off most of our radars and just off our shores lurk our most not-so-apparent traitors, the U.S. companies who have set up shop in the Bahamas and elsewhere to avoid taxation. It's called tax-motivated expatriation. It's a nice corporate phrase for freeloading, and it's a tax code loophole that allows U.S. companies to enjoy all the benefits provided by the United States government without the nuisance of having to pay for them, like stealing but without any masks. And it's all approved by Congress. And of course, these American companies don't actually have to move to the Bahamas, which just shows you how dumb they are. The money gets to live in the Caribbean and stay in Newark, New Jersey. They just have to set up a post office box on the island, essentially a phone and a monkey with some kind of mailbox to collect their money and deposit it in the bank so that it can be spent here in America. And I do mean bloody blood money, and I'll bet the money, or the desire to keep it, has killed more American soldiers than the Iraqi army ever has or ever will. Folks of a certain age will remember a play called All My Sons. And I remember the movie on TV with Edgar G. Robinson as a wartime airplane manufacturer who scrimps on the making of certain bolts that then caused planes to crash and pilots to die, among them his son. But of course, too late, he realizes that they were all his sons. That might have been a good movie to see for some of the folks running Eagle Pilcher or making the batteries for our smart bombs, since employees have come forward to accuse the company of allegedly rigging computers to show live responses from dead batteries, making test reports and gluing up cracks in battery casings to save the company hundreds of thousands of dollars, which would have been great business savvy. How does Vice President Martin sound? If the faulty batteries hadn't made the smart bombs dumb and caused the friendly fire deaths of several U.S. troops in Afghanistan. But the corporate mindset in America isn't really that different from the mayor in Jaws. Yes, there's a shark out there, but don't tell the people. Then the worst possible thing will happen. and we'll all lose business. It's practically our national credo. What's good for business is good for America. Well, no, fraud can be good for business. Sweatshops are good for business. Children work cheap, you know. The tax cheats in the Caribbean who were AWOL assholes with official leave love to give you that malarkey about how without the taxes they can cut the cost of the products that they're making. Yes, and slavery is a real cost cutter too. The Civil War was the original, it's the economy, stupid war that we fought, remember? Besides, the money isn't really getting trickled down anyway. The ratio of CEO compensation to average worker salary in 1980 was 42. In 2000, that gap had grown more than tenfold, and a CEO now makes 531 times what the average worker does in American corporate business. Rich people did very, very well over the past two decades. Reagan and Clinton were a golden 1-2 economic punch for the wealthy. But now it's time to give back and not forget that that kind of wealth was only made possible because it was accrued in a country that, with all of its flaws, is the envy of the world precisely because we have functioning government agencies like the IRS that allow people to conduct commerce. Without the SEC and the Federal Reserve, not to mention the FBI and a kick-ass army, as we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq, the conditions for amassing this wealth simply would not exist. But some people always want to argue the bill, even in wartime. Well, the IRS estimates that this offshore tax dodge siphons $70 billion each year from our U.S. Treasury, which is approximately our entire tab spent on terrorism in the first year. That $70 billion a year would go a long ways toward paying the bills on the war on terrorism, wouldn't it? The connection that we have to make here is simply this. Politicians respond to pressure, and if they don't think the people are outraged about something, then it slips off their agenda. There are fundraisers to attend, lobbyists to entertain, and mistresses to screw. And we have to let them know in Washington what makes us mad at home, and this kind of nonsense certainly should. And any idiot can win votes coming out against taxes. We all hate taxes. We all hate the IRS. But many nations would love to have an effective way of collecting legitimately needed tax revenue. And unfortunately, with highway robberies like this, we are becoming one of them. Now, Bill Maher uses some pretty salty language, but I think that he illustrates the view of all of us. After all, it's like reading Mad Magazine, isn't it? They're telling you the truth, even if you don't like the source. It's where reality is really located. Hey, I gotta break off right here. We're just about out of time. You've been listening to The Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and The Law Hour has been brought to you by the Gordon Law School as an educational service in the public interest. And for more information about The Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information on the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal that says our time is up. We're going to have to leave it right there. It's been good being with you. And I'll see you back here tomorrow, God willing, same time, same station. So until then, goodbye, friends.